Mr. Fiddler, Reel 8. We're talking about the actions of, well, we're talking about lagers during the Epsom battle, really. Mm. We'd had a look at the layout, and you mentioned the guards. Yeah. What was it like being on guard duty overnight?
Being on duty at night was frightening. Each tank had to supply one member for a certain period of time, maybe 2 hours, and then another member of the tank would you would go back and I came out and he would then do it. But there was machine gunning all night. There was the sky happened to be, you always lit up with tracer moving across. You could hear shells going on in the distance. There was always shelling, a wee bit of bombing going on at all times, but it was a frightening experience.
And that wasn't so much near you; it was just on the front. Shelling and bombing.
Because we're way back out of the. I think it's fair to say that the tanks moved back to Leader or Harbour, probably half a mile or a mile from any likelihood of an attack. You had to have infantry between you and. Then we went on I think we were then taken out, the whole regiment, the whole division was taken out for 3 days, a 3 day rest period. Now this involved going to the showers. We were had all their shirts, all their kit was replaced with laundered stuff. So we had shirts, underpants, socks, we had a complete change and showers. It was then that we began to talk and realise who hadn't come back and who was not likely to come back. We were getting together a little bit then. We were talking, but we were also, getting a wee bit battle-hardened, if we can use that phrase. We didn't want to go out again after 3 days, but we were prepared to go.
Were you getting? I mean, you'd been quite frank about it. You were scared after you'd seen these tanks go up, and did it get worse, the same, or easier for you as
I think it got. From there, well, from a little bit later on, I think it's fair to say life got a wee bit easier. Although I believe that the 11th Armoured Division, came in at this particular time, not at a bad time, but when Germany or with the German Panzer divisions was at their best. In other words, I think it's fair to say that when D-Day started, there was, I think, probably only one Panzer division in the area at that particular time. And it took about 2 weeks before they had, I think, three Panzer divisions opposing us. And I think we came in at this time. In other words, I think a bad time for us.
Had you formed any opinion of the German tanks?
I feel that the Germans all round were good. I think they were, I'm not going to turn around and say they're better, but they had a lot more to put up with than what we ever did. And I think what we ever could have taken, that's my opinion of the Germans.
What about that? I mean, had you actually seen German tanks yet? I mean, from your perspective.
That's the funny thing. No, we hadn't. I personally hadn't seen it, but Steele Brownley had and shot at. But I personally hadn't seen.
Had you decided that things like the Panther and the Tiger were better than the Sherman? I mean, I think they probably were. But did you think at the time they were? Grasped it?
Well, let's say. Every time a Panther or Tiger would mention, we began to use toilet paper. And I mean that literally. We were scared stiff. But I will also say that every tank that was seen was a panther or a tiger, and it wasn't. Everybody used this word tiger, and I think other people tell you, tiger panther, and it wasn't a tiger panther. It was ingrained, I think, in the mind.
Were all the German tanks better than yours? I mean, is it Mark IV?
We had the Mark IV. It was probably equivalent to what we were driving.
So
it was one of their early tanks.
So you'd think the Mark IV was about the same as a Sherman, but if they saw a Mark IV, they'd call it a Panther.
Yeah, yeah. I feel that. If there's a big gun, it's sort of the equivalent. If the big gun is a little one, well, it's a big gun that's facing me. It's a tank, it's a tiger that's facing me. And half the time it wasn't. You know, there was a lot of Mark IVs about as well. And, of course, there was a lot of self-propelled guns, which was literally had the 88s as well.
What about the 88 gun? I mean, you had the 75, they had the 88,
yeah.
And there was the 88.
There was no comparison. You just could not compare them. Normally, the shot from a 75 would bounce off the Tiger and the Panther. There was just no comparison. There was no comparison. Full stop. Now, as far as the 17-pounder was concerned, totally and we're talking about a little bit different now. That was a very good gun, but it wasn't on par, a little lower than the 88.
Let's talk about that. What was good about it then, and bad about it in comparison of the 17-pounder? It's bigger than the 75, isn't it? Millimetre, isn't it?
Yes. It's and it was bigger than the 17-pounder. I'm not quite sure what the equivalent in millimetres with the 17-pounder, but it was a bigger gun, much bigger gun than the.
The 88 was bigger than the 17.
Was much bigger than the 17-pounder. The velocity of a gun. You could literally hear, not in a tank, but you could literally hear an 88 millimeter gun fire, and it was in your lap within is the same time as it fired the gun. Now this is literally right. You could hear it fire, and it would be in your lap at the same time. And of course, it was a dual purpose gun. They also had it for anti aircraft, but this could be turned into anti-tank, which was found at Caen. Three anti-tank guns that was turned on as a anti-tank gun from anti-aircraft. Apparently it was said that the bloke that was in charge of these three guns was told to use it as an anti-tank gun, and it's all hearsay. This.
I think they've used them in the desert as well.
Yeah.
What? This is a difficult thing to talk about. You mentioned how scared you were. Was there a particular horror of being burnt, trapped and burnt, or was it just general?
I think you had to be hit before you could really say that. I mean, I don't think anybody has got the know of being burnt unless you are burnt. I think you had to be to really say that. Oh yeah, we didn't want to be knocked out. We didn't want to have to be hit. We didn't want to bail out. But I think it's very very difficult to say I don't want to be burnt. I mean, yeah, nobody wants to be burned, but you knew, or you had an idea that if you were going to be hit, the tank would fire. But it wasn't always the case that it didn't happen with me in my first one.
Right. Well, I think we'll. Kind of, what else would you do? I mean, we've gotten a bit tangled up there. What else would you do in your rest period? You know.
I think we were far enough back, and I think there were games arranged, and I don't think there was I don't think there was much done on the tank. In other words, I don't think there was a lot of training to do, because I think it was letters home. You know, you had to get right letters home, and I believe there was a game or two of football, but I know there was. But I'm pretty sure that we were taken out of the mould training, because I personally don't think we needed any more training. I think we were having enough.
Now, what about, you mentioned letters home, that, what about that? How important was that, getting letters, writing letters, perhaps parcels?
Receiving letters was very, 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 very much, and the parcel. But the parcel would, you would share with your crew, literally. It was very important to get a letter.
Let's talk about the letters.
It was very difficult to write a letter home.
Why?
Well, because you had to be very careful, because you knew very well that they were going to be checked over by they were going to be done by the troop leader,
which is Steele Brownlee. Steele
Brownlee, and he would go through the letters. But he did. I know very well that he did say that I should be lenient one way, as long as there's no relative information that would be helpful to anybody else. Did I find it difficult to write home? I wanted to write home. Did I find it difficult? Yes, it was very difficult. What do you put in? Well, Mum, I'm all right. You know, the food's good. You know, I hope my sisters are. What did you write home? But
did you avoid writing about the nasty side of it?
Well, you couldn't really. Well, you couldn't. I think sometimes I think sometimes I put down that I didn't put down there that I was scared of anything, because I think that was putting the wind up. But
you tried not to worry.
I think this basically what one tried not to. But as I say, it was very difficult to write a letter home until you got in. You know, in the early days, I found it difficult.
Now, what about letters from home? Why were they so important? What would they write to you? That might have been quite difficult for them as well.
Well, they were.
Who wrote?
Yes, I think my father. I think my father. And the amazing thing is, I always used to get the Newbury Weekly News wrapped up. I always used to get that. But letters mainly from home, I think, was what the next door neighbour was doing. Of course, we didn't, as I told you before, that we didn't have anybody. I think I was the only one that was in the services in the village that I was born in. But it was always what the local farmer was doing, what my father, what he was doing, and what my mother was doing, because she was, as I said, working in this Allied supplier. And it was just general talk, because they didn't have a lot to talk about, because there wasn't no bomb around the area.
That's a very different world from what you were living in. Was it comforting? I mean, how did you feel about it?
Oh, it was certainly a different world, because I think it's also fair to say that my mother lived, or my mother and father, they lived quite well, because they were on an estate, and they went without little. She used to make her own butter, and milk was no problem. She used to make her own cream, all this sort of thing. So they lived very, very well.
But how did you feel about hearing about that different world? Was it comforting, or did you feel it? Do you want to be back, or what did you?
No, I don't think I wanted to be. I wouldn't. I don't. I think it's fair to say at that time that I wasn't looking for leave. But leave wasn't talked about anyway. But I wasn't looking to go home. You know, or you could probably turn around and say, so you were happy. No, I wasn't happy, but I suppose if I said to you that we had a job to do, that sounds a load of baloney, but you know, we were out there, we hadn't been out there long, other people had been in the war a lot longer, and than I was. So I didn't mind these letters coming in. Looked forward to the letter coming in. I looked forward to the parcels.
Now, what would be in the parcels? So you've got the newspaper, perhaps.
There would be different. In fact, I used to smoke in those days, not heavy. I didn't used to take it back. Used to be a few cigarettes. There would always be a homemade cake. Few sweets, not chocolate sweets. And I got a feeling there was a tin of bully, or no, certainly wasn't bully, but a tin of such like or something or other. So it was a parcel that we could use round the troop that would last probably an hour. You know, we'd always have a big.
Would you share around? Would you share around the troop or around the tank? No, the tank. Yeah.
There wouldn't have to go around the troop, and everybody else was having. Mainly everybody else was getting a parcel. There was always some that didn't.
Did everyone share in your tank?
Yeah. Even when I was in with the Scots boys. Oh yeah, they did. All right, they didn't have so many maybe parcels as I had. But what they had, I think we could say we shared, which went a long way.
Now, anything else about when you were out of the line on rest?
No, nothing specific. I think the main thing was on this rest period was going to the showers and a change of. You felt clean. You went there dirty, because sometimes you were lucky to shave, although it was a question of shaving, and normally it was shaving with with cold water, although we were able to heat it if we had the time. Our problem was when we used to have the occasional stop, brew up in the tank, which wasn't allowed, but we used to get out the gun at the radio, the wireless operator would often do this. Get the tea made.
How would you brew?
Move in 2 minutes. Sorry.
How would you brew up in the tank?
Oh, we had a. had a little. But this was not allowed. But even we used to, and it would be with the little cooker, tank cooker would be put on the face of the turret, and then we used to have a Dixie, and he would make the tea then and there. The boiling water, and then he put the tea into the boiling water and let it scuttle around. And 9 times out of 10, we just poured our cups of tea, moved in 2 minutes, and the lot had to go over the side of the turret. And this happened on many, many occasions. It seemed as if somebody was waiting for us to put the kettle on, or the pot on, and this happened.
Now, the next big action I think we'll go on to is July 17th, well, 18th, I think it is, and this is Operation Goodwood,
Oh, yeah, this.
what do you remember of that?
Well, this was a big day, because everybody thought that when once we can get... Although a lot of divisions had been trying to break out of calm for a long, long time, but this one was the big one. We were moved up... three divisions. Sorry.
How were you briefed before it? I mean, what level of briefing did you get?
We were told that there was going to be three divisions. There was going to be the 11th, the 7th, and the Guards, Armoured Division, that would be in this attack. And we were beginning to think this would be a full frontal attack, but it couldn't have been. There were going to be 1,000. There was going to be 1,000 bomber raid before the attack went in. And there would be, I think, a 500 or 750 gun moving, a creeping barrage. Oh, this is marvellous. This is a piece of cake. This is what we've come over here for. This is what we all thought. We were all ready. Everything was ready. The tanks were filled up after the move nearer. Then the morning came along, and there was the planes took over, and it was a mass. There were nearly, if I remember, there was a lot of fortresses, and they were well up. And you could see every now and again, because we were sat on air tanks watching all this going over, or watching all this, and every now and again there'd be a plane hit, and you'd see a fort coming down from 70,000 feet. You could just see the thing whirling around like that. And there was a few. There was airplanes as well. That stopped, and then this creeping barrage went on. Oh, this is good. We couldn't wait.
Was the barrage impressive? I mean, could you see that?
Oh, we can't lose. You see, we were told that the Germans will not be able to... Couldn't get out of this. I can't remember the word. They can't survive. They just can't survive. And when we saw all this clutter going over, and then this creeping barrage of all these guns, and I'm not sure how many guns each how many shells each gun fired. Then we couldn't get away quick enough. We all wanted to go. Well, anyway, I think I'm right in saying that the fighters were the first to move. The 11th Armoured was in the lead, followed by the 7th, and followed by the Guards. We tried to start up and couldn't start up. So we lose our crew commander. Still Brownlee has to get into another tank because he can't stay back with us.
Now, why didn't the tank start?
Well, later on in the day, it has come up. Somebody's put water in the petrol. Now, you know, I told you back just now about air petrol cans are these square cans, just an ordinary tin can, but you know, and we used to use one for our own water. Anyway, water in the tank. Nobody got blamed, but it seemed as if it was obviously came from the crew. Well, this wasn't so, as far as I'm concerned, because we were wanting to go. So we have to stay back all day, and that's a bad day for us for the simple reason that from the time, probably from about 2 hours on, we can hear one hell of a guns. You know, you can literally hear an 88 going. And there was these guns going off. There was one hell of a shebang, probably about 3 to 5 miles in front of us. So we're only supposing this is what's happening. And then crews start coming back, bailed out crews. And we're then told, you know, later on in the day, the division lost 113 tanks, and I think there was 47 tanks of the 5 and 4 that got knocked out. But after we hear all what's gone on and we read what happened, we were, I suppose, really glad to hear that we hadn't been in this action. So,
what was the state?
We're back at what they call the glider field. The big glider field where this was used on D-Day, where the gliders came in.
Would that be at Ranville?
Yeah. And we're more or less perched or parked under the wings of these gliders, and of course we're stationary anyway. And Echelon's moved up with us because we're still sort of 5 miles back. And as the day goes on, we hear rumours of what's happened. We hear, of course, that the squadron's been lost, the regiment's been lost, but this isn't the case anyway. But we do lose a lot of tanks. Night comes along, and then Jerry decides then to put a bomber attack on the glider field where all the tank crews have gone back to. And of course, there's we're literally safe because we're inside the tank, or in fact, all lid down. when we're attacked. So there's bombs going all around us, but they're mainly anti-tank, anti-personnel bombs that's dropped.
Would they not? If a bomb hit the tank direct?
Oh, it would. It'd shake you up a lot, but it wouldn't put you out of action. Not because it was anti-personnel, mainly anti-personnel. But they did wreck the Gloderfield, and there were many, many casualties. And these were mainly from, unfortunately, blokes that had bailed out crews. And there was a lot lost there in the regiment.
What was the state of the bailed out crews, you know, when they got back to you?
Well, they were half of them were really bomb happy, because they'd gone up into the Germans. They got dug in when this bombing took place, and as soon as the bombing had stopped, they then come up with their guns. The guns had been, not, I don't mean sunk down in, but they were down below the, they opened up on us, and they were coming in from the, you know, coming the shell, coming from the left, coming from the right, and then, as I told you before, there was these three anti-aircraft 88s that were brought in, and I think these were the three that done a lot of damage to the regiment. And then I believe the RTR was over on their left, then I think the Hussars, this is hearsay, so, and then I think the Hussars went through.
And you said, what signs of bomb happiness did they show? I mean,
they came back, and they you couldn't talk to them. They didn't really want to tell you anything about it. You know, they more or less wanted you out of the way. They were in a state of, I don't know where I am. And it was really frightening to see these people coming back and didn't want to speak. They couldn't speak of what happened. Apparently there was, literally tanks burnt out, flaming all over the place. I don't know. I wasn't there. And
was there any investigation that night or into this water in the petrol tank at all, or was it?
We never heard any more about it. I think Steele Brownlee, I think he mentioned it in his. But nobody was ever accused. But I don't know how it got there. I don't know if anybody would turn around and say, yes, it was me, put it in there, if it was. But I can't really believe that there was anybody. After going through what we did, we were then told that we're on the move, we're going to make the breakout across the plains of Corn, and you better go, look what's gone over, they can't survive. And this was and I think also we would say that we wanted to be a part of it. I know it didn't in the early days, but I think this was something that we wanted to be a part of.
So that night you had the bombing raid. What else happened that night? There wouldn't be many tanks left.
Well, a lot. You bear in mind that there was some of the 113 that was recoverable, that were to be able to, you know, where crews got out.
So who would recover those tanks? Whose job would that be?
Oh, that would be the I don't know whether it would be the Ford delivery squadron. These were the people that brought in tanks to replenish areas that had been. I don't know, but it was nothing. We'd had new crews come up and new tanks was replaced the ones that were knocked out. But as I say, a lot of them, or some of these, could be recoverable.
And when would the replacement tanks arrive? Would they arrive that night?
No, they'd in the following morning.
That
we weren't, I don't think we were ready to move off. It was in such a... I think the squadron, well, the regiment, the whole division was in a state of turmoil, really. I think things went wrong. They I think they tried to get three divisions through and they just couldn't. There was bottlenecks here and bottlenecks there.
And what about your tank? What had to be done to that to get this water out of the petrol? Or had it
Now, if I remember rightly, I think that the tank was taken back. I think the fitters took it, but no, they couldn't have done because we were in it through the night. I believe it was replaced. I believe, and yet I can't remember getting into another tank. I don't know.
I mean, would it affect the engine? I mean, the water and the petrol, had that caused the engine to seize up, or would it just have to be drained?
Well, I don't know. I think personally it was drained, but this is something else that I don't know. But I'm pretty sure that we didn't get into another tank.